Cette deuxième journée de notre conférence. Aujourd'hui, nous aurons deux conférenciers à ma droite, Olivette Otele, qui est de l'université de Bath Spa au Pays de Galles. Olivette est historienne de formation et donc spécialiste, bien évidemment, de la question de l'esclavage. Et à ma gauche, Ronan Orcade, aussi spécialiste de l'esclavage, qui travaille essentiellement sur... Sa démarche est plutôt comparative parce qu'il regarde la question de la mémoire de l'esclavage dans trois villes différentes et deux pays. Donc il y a Bristol, c'est ma mémoire est bonne, il y a Nantes et il y a Bordeaux également. Et Liverpool. Et donc ce que je vais faire, puisqu'on a déjà, on est déjà un peu en retard, je vais très rapidement passer la parole à Olivette, qui aura 40 minutes pour présenter son texte. Et puis après, nous passerons à la session questions-réponses. Et on aura une pause par la suite. Et après, Ronan Orcade va présenter et on va procéder de la même façon. Je donne la parole à Olivette.
Merci. Alors, je ferai ma présentation en anglais, mais bien sûr, les questions, vous pouvez les poser en français. Voilà. So, in October 2013, the British Cultural Secretary announced that Prime Minister David Cameron's government was going to fund a project that focused on the uniqueness of Britain's island story. That sparked a controversy about rewriting a history centered on the nation's mainland-based events or actors. A year later, by-elections showed a steady move towards a party that actively supports the nation's withdrawal from the European Union. I offered a counter-narrative to this so-called island story. I did that by writing about the Atlantic connections Britain had in the 19th century in the article entitled Resisting Imperial Governance in Canada from Trade and Religious Kinship to Black Narrative Pedagogy in Ontario. I looked at the relationship between British and Canadian abolitionists, and I examined how British migrants settled in Canada and got involved in the fight for the abolition of slavery. A few weeks ago, another controversy started. Prime Minister David Cameron made a significant move towards Jamaica, a nation that, as we know, can tell more than one story about Britain's involvement in the slave trade. Whilst there, he refused to talk about reparations, and even advised Jamaicans to move on. Cameron announced a £25 million in British aid for a new Jamaican prison and added a £300 million development package for the Caribbean. The project is aimed at providing money to help build bridges, roads, etc. There are currently 600 Jamaican prisoners in British jail. Cameron explained, I can't make his voice, so I'll say, it is absolutely right that foreign criminals who break our laws are properly punished, but this shouldn't be at the expense of the hard-working British taxpayer. End quote. A lot has already been written about that. It has been argued that Jamaica did not need another prison, and £300 million couldn't qualify as reparation money, especially when part of this money, aid money, is in fact there, and I'm quoting Prime Minister once again, to create opportunities for British business, end of quote. So what could be the links between Cameron and Jamaica? Well, the findings of a research led by Catherine Hall called The Legacies of British Slave Ownership have provided us with a list and details of slave owners who received compensation after the abolition of slavery. Prime Minister Cameron's wife, Samantha, is descended from the 19th century businessman William Jolliffe, who received £4,000 in compensation for 164 slaves. Cameron himself is a distant relative of General Sir James Duff. Duff was the son of Cameron's great-granduncle, the great Earl of Fife. He was awarded £4,101, about £3 million in today's money, to compensate him for the 202 slaves he lost after abolition. One could say that this is a touchy subject for the elite in Britain. The argument put forward is that reparations will be taken from taxpayers' money and put a strain on hard-working citizens. Again, we find the narrative of us and them, British citizens, taxpayers, and them, those who are not included in the island story. So the question of reparations is a slippery slope for the whole nation. The question of the memory of slavery, not only reparation, is a very controversial issue in Britain. It also shows how the debate is at the heart of questions of identities. There are constant links between institutional and official memory and the Conservative Party's plan to redefine what it means to be British, including within the confine of public space. There is not, at this point, a visible fight between public memory and official memory, especially when most of the work done on public memory has been done over the last few years with the financial support of state through major grant like the Heritage Lottery Funds, etc. The focal point seems to be about reparations nowadays, but however subtle it may seem, there is still a battle. I'm arguing that between these competing narratives, the role of descendants of slaves had been, if not forgotten, at least put aside to deal with what seems to be more pressing issues, identity and social cohesion. Hence Cameron's remark about moving on. In that context of memorial battles, of increased Euroscepticism fueled by a perceived threat of high immigration from Africa, the Middle East, and Eastern European countries, it is worth remembering that Britain, as I said, island stories were shaped by the nation's connections with the Atlantic world. Cultural theorist Stuart Hall showed that memory narratives, myths were intertwined. But the past is not factual only. Our understanding of slavery is also our present, our legacy, and our fight as human beings to continue. Talking about shared experience and recognition, I'd like to take this opportunity to warmly thank Johan Michel and Abdoulaye Gay for inviting me and for creating that wonderful space of exchange and intellectual debate, really. Christine Chivalon's not here, but she was an inspiration for me at many levels, challenging at many levels as well. Myriam Cotillas not here as well, but she supported me for making things happen. And finally, Christiane Taubira is not here as well, but that's okay, because she's the reason why I swapped from working on Welsh literature to doing history, and in particular the history of the transatlantic slave trade. Okay. So coming back to today's topic, my presentation will examine the ways in which individual and collective memories are produced and intertwined. I will talk about memory as a basis for cultural and communicative memories. The aim is to show how the process that led to the production of these memories influenced the way they are displayed, enacted, and performed in British sites of memory. So, oops, ah, c'est pas un Apple alors. Comment on fait pour just move, yeah, there. Thank you. Comment t'as fait? Just that. Thanks. Je vais pas lire tout le quote. Memory is therefore, Aristotle said, memory is therefore neither perception nor conception, but a state of affection of one of these conditioned by lapse of time. You don't need to read the whole thing, but what you need to remember is that, one, memory implies that it implies that first memory becomes meaningful only after a certain period of time. Second, what helps us remember or the tool that and the way the past is represented matters and influences what is remembered. There is the human ability to keep and bring back ideas or personal experiences when needed. We know that Freud developed the idea that events and experiences are stored into the unconscious and the conscious mind. So memory involves a process where these event experiences go through a processing phase before being stored. Those reorganized information are, according to psychologists and psychiatrists, permanently kept somewhere in our mind. Bringing back these stored elements can be achieved by external or internal triggers, meaning a specific situation. Talking about specific situation, let's briefly examine the idea of triggers. Novelist Marcel Proust is part of France's intellectual heritage. Marcel Proust with a Madeleine story explained how every time he ate a Madeleine, some memories would come back to him. Proust showed that bringing back memory is not always intentional. That is what has been called later involuntary memory. But what happens when these experiences are not only individual but collective, and when they remain in the unconscious? Well, Carl Jung suggested that there was such a thing as collective unconsciousness, defined as such, a part of the unconscious mind shared by a society, a people, or all humankind that is the product of ancestral experience and contains such concepts as science, religion, and morality. Sociologist Maurice Halbwachs contended that our memory is based on collective experience. Philosopher Paul Ricoeur went further and noted that remembering and forgetting were two sides of the same coin. Ricoeur voiced his concern about the excess of remembering and forgetting. And Professor Johann Michel, forgive me, I know your work on Ricoeur, and I steer clear of any attempt to analyze and explain Ricoeur today. I'll focus on public act of remembrance instead. So, collective conscious unconsciousness could be a compulsion. Jacques Lacan explained that the trauma often leads to patterns of repetition. So we have collective unconsciousness, collective memory. We also see emerging ideas about trauma and even compulsion. Now, returning to the context or specific situation I mentioned previously, that can trigger a trip to memory lane. What could have led Britain to remember the transatlantic slavery in the 20th century? In 2007, for the bicentenary of the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade, Britain focused on key abolitionists, mostly ignoring Caribbean involvement in emancipation. A movie was produced. That was just me playing with your mind. I'll skip that one. Yeah. The movie was produced called Amazing Grace. The focus was on the life of abolitionist and MP William Wilberforce. That started a controversy and angered members of various communities. Activist Toyin Akbetu deemed the whole ceremony not Wilberforce, but Wilberfarce. One may remember how he disrupted the ceremony, so now this is where technology has to work.
Well, the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade was disrupted today by a protester who came within yards of the Queen. Toyin Akbetu shouted at the congregation of 2,000, "You should be ashamed." Nicholas Witchell reports.
The service had brought together the descendants of some of those who were enslaved, together with descendants of those who, 200 years ago, had campaigned for the end of the trafficking by Britain of millions of Africans to the New World. The Queen was sitting with her husband close to the high altar. Close by were the Prime Minister and other senior members of the government. The service had reached its most solemn moments. The Dean of Westminster was leading an act of penitence when the protester stepped forward, unchallenged, from the Abbey's south transept. As he approached, the Queen looked up. He stopped at the bottom of the steps, at the top of which the Queen was seated.
Let go! You said you were going to go! Let go!
The service came to a halt. The congregation watched as, still standing a few yards from the Queen, the protester, Toyin Akbetu, demanded that Britain issue a formal apology for its part in the slave trade.
The word sorry is so hard to say, and you free. Can you let it off a punch ground?
Mr. Akbetu shouted directly at the Prime Minister sitting in the choir stalls before he finally withdrew.
There. Okay. So, where were we? So, the context and therefore the trigger for the controversy were important. It was at a time when the then Prime Minister Tony Blair was promoting his policy on multiculturalism. The idea was to try and follow what he saw as a successful Canadian model of integration of various communities. The ceremony in that specific case was a prime example of what we remember, example of how what we remember is just as important as the way we are made to remember. It's the idea of power structure and the whole discursive field of power. What is told? Who's telling the story? Who's the audience? Who is the intended audience? Maurice Halvax contended that memory is a process that is created through social experience that lives on through collective narratives. He called it collective memory. Aleida and Jan Asman drew from Halvax's work, and came up with the idea of communicative memory. It is the memory that is shared by groups of people and that has been transmitted verbally over a period of time. They limited that time to 80 to 100 years, so it is a, quote, fresh, verbal, close proximity kind of memory, end of quote. This notion is very useful when it comes to oral history and interviews and family history. Now, it could be argued that it is not how we remember, or sometimes even what we remember. The problem is that we remember too much. Pierre Nora mentioned it, but I want to include Paul Ricoeur's quote here in the preface of his book, Memory, History and Forgetting. He writes, "He is troubled by the unsettling spectacle offered by an excess of memory here and an excess of forgetting elsewhere, to say nothing of the influence of commemorations and abuses of memory and of forgetting." So what can be done to counteract that? He suggested that there's the need to have a group of people who manage collective memory. However, this raises the question of who is responsible for such a policy and who decides what is just la mémoire juste. It has been argued that state and state institutions and other interest groups were adequate venues. So to come back to the British case, memory is based on daily communication, based on shared experience, interaction, and similarity of cultural references. Failing to address the legacies of slavery and focusing on the abolition of slavery in 2007 for the bicentenary certainly mark a new turn in race relations in Britain, and on the idea of the shared values of multiculturalism that Blair was trying to promote. Multiculturalism did take a beating that day at Westminster Abbey. For detractors, this was the result of lack of planning when it comes to commemorations, and this was basically resulting the failure to understand Britain's minority ethnic communities in the 20th century. Possibly. However, I'd like to explain that prior to that commemoration, and in fact since 2003, a lot of funds have been dedicated to addressing the gaps or partial amnesia that the UK was suffering from. A vast project started in 2003 about the history of British transatlantic slavery. The focus was on teaching and learning. The project was a collaborative effort between the Department of Culture, Media, Sport, Department of Education, Heritage and Museum sectors. This is quite important because the aim was to link narrative pedagogy, narrative andragogy, meaning adult learning, and address race relations as well as emphasize common heritage. Already we can see that the aim was quite noble, but it is in the delivery that things might have gone wrong. It was not just the ceremony, it was the ways in which the history of the transatlantic slavery and the history of slavery were presented. There are three common images that I found in museums, but I'll go very quickly because I chopped that bit. I just wanted to say that there have been studies about museums and gallery and slave trade galleries in Bristol. I've written a paper about it. Before that, Christine Chivalon has worked on it. Matt Dresser has worked on it. There is some literature about it. I'm skipping. There. I need more than one presentation to show that those sites of memory here, museums, have proven to be complex and interesting terrain to measure the ways in which questions of identity, heritage, and social cohesion are articulated in Britain. I'd like to briefly look at another site of memory that is related more closely to the question of heritage. Heritage, on dirait en français, patrimoine. Country houses. They are allegedly quintessentially British. They are the pride and joy of the Queen's subjects. They are represented in period dramas that have reached a favourable audience in the US and Canada. Some of you may be aware of Jane Austen's movies. Some of you may even have seen Downton Abbey, a very popular series in Britain and in the States. Historians James Wolven showed that the links between country houses and slavery in 2008. More recently, Matt Dresser and Andrew Hahn also tackled the topic. This is Harewood House, near Leeds in the north of England. Harewood House was built by a landowner, Edwin Lascelles. His father, Henry, owned a plantation in Barbados, His asset when he died was worth £52 million in today's money. Harewood House is a beautiful specimen of English heritage, heritage based on money made from the transatlantic slavery. I want to briefly look at another country house in particular, and that is Piercefield House, because it's in Wales, and it is where my family and I live. So, but before we look at that country house, this is when the idea of cultural memory is very useful. Jan Asman, Jan Asman defined cultural memory as the outer dimension of human memory, society's ability to preserve its collective memory and to pass it on to the next generation through cultural artifacts. To quote Stavros Kamis, society's capability to reconstruct a cultural identity from this collective memory. So cultural memory is about understanding the past in the present cultural setting. You have Mick Powell, who says this. He says, cultural memory allows a way of thinking outside the roles played by particular social institutions in the formation of memory, etc., etc. Practically speaking, it's about the use of the site of memory. So I'm going back to Pierre Nora, lieu de mémoire, site of memory. Nora said something really interesting here. He said, memory is open to the dialectic of remembering and forgetting, unconscious of its successful deformation, vulnerable to manipulation and appropriation, susceptible to being long dormant and periodically reviewed. What he's saying is that sites of memory are, of course, museum, archive, cemetery, etc. So Piercefield House is a typical site of memory. There. The house was built in the 15th century, renovated in 1700, sold to Valentine Morris, the son of a sugar planter and a merchant. Morris went bankrupt, sold it to someone else in 1770s, left for the West Indies. The house changed hands several times, and in 1800, the owner, Mark Wood, an MP, sold it to Nathaniel Wells, the son of a black slave and a sugar planter merchant from St. Kitts. Wells's father was born in Cardiff. Nathaniel Wells was his father's favorite, so he was sent to Britain and educated, where he was educated. He became the first black sheriff in Britain. He later left the area, and the house has several owners and was abandoned now and was became derelict. Now, the connection with slavery is hardly made, although several owners were involved in the trade, including Wells. I just told you about the pride Britain takes in restoring and showing off her country houses. Piercefield hasn't had the same opportunity. Why? Because it's in Wales. The proper term is not British country houses, it's English country house. This gives an insight into regional tensions. I have written an article on the matter. It's free, it's available, it's online, and it's called, it's in French, Multiculturalisme et Régionalisme, les apories d'une identité britannique au pays de Galles. The paper is about the fact that Wales was conquered and colonized by England. The cohabitation was bloody and painful. Welsh language and history has been obliterated in national discourse. Now, because of empire, Welsh soldiers, settlers, and sailors were found in every corner of empire. Empire offered the opportunity for a better life. That, however, also meant that Wales is and have always been, and unfortunately still is, resistant to questions of multiculturalism, race discrimination, etc., etc. There are black, Welsh, British people. Okay, and this is interesting. It's just something I want to say in French. En France, on n'aime pas les statistiques ethniques. Comme vous le savez, en Grande-Bretagne, on n'aime pas, on est autorisé à les faire quand il s'agit de la recherche, mais on n'aime pas en général. En Grande-Bretagne, on les fait tout le temps et surtout. Vous pouvez me demander pourquoi. Je vous réponds que pour mesurer l'impact de la discrimination, la Grande-Bretagne considère qu'elles sont importantes. Par exemple, je vais parler des profs d'université. En Grande-Bretagne, en histoire, il y a un seul prof noir en histoire dans tout le pays. En Grande-Bretagne, il y a 17 professeurs noirs, femmes. Comment on sait ça? Ce sont les statistiques ethniques qui peuvent nous le dire. Yeah. Yeah. Toutes les spécialités. Yeah. So, coming back to empire, let me see, where was I? I'm arguing that not talking about Nathaniel Wells is part of that narrative that is aimed at discarding what does not fit within the discourse of Welsh identity. Welsh identity is articulated around key points: music, the famous Welsh choirs, rugby, and a strong involvement in politics, traditionally the Labour Party in Plaid Cymru. Welsh involvement in the slave trade is well known. Mention of that past is minimal in the National Museum of Wales. Skip. Historian Chris Evans showed the trading relations between Wales and Africa and the West Indies. So it's not as if it doesn't exist. It exists. It's been recorded and examined, but it just doesn't appear at the public sphere. So the character who is often of interest is Lord Richard Pennon, First Lord Penryn. I studied the ways in which Wales represents slavery. The focus has been on abolition. The argument is that Wales was a small player in that trade. It is therefore understandable to put less emphasis on that part of history. The reason does not seem valid to me. The English curriculum, key stage 3 and 4, meaning children who are 12 to 14 years old, they learn about the history of Britain under the section Political Changes. Suggestions or recommendations are made, curriculum meaningly programme scolaire, and they are advised to look at the history of the transatlantic slave trade, at the abolition rather than at the history. In other words, they have to choose between the abolition of slavery, Queen Victoria, and other reformers. So it's up to the teacher to decide which bit they want to look at. In Wales, the curriculum is different. The emphasis is on Welsh history. Lord Penryn, I mentioned, and his grandson are widely studied because they were prime examples of wealthy factory owners who fought against social reforms before finally caving in and agreeing to listen to their workers. No mention whatsoever is made in the curriculum about the origin of the family's wealth at all, not even slavery. This is an interesting example of how the memory of slavery competes with other memories and how entrepreneurs of memory in Wales have chosen to focus on what they see as key elements. Those elements are aimed at bringing communities together over a legacy and pride about the fight for inequality. Wales, as I mentioned, is a strong bastion for the Labour Party, a party that supposedly represents the working class. So identity, heritage are mixed here. Heritage and tourism, rugby, choir, Welsh coast, Celtic heritage become an attraction that further sediment official memories and, by extension, identities. In every major city that dealt with the transatlantic slave trade, there is a slave trail. London, Bristol. Oh yeah, I put that map just in case. See, earlier on you said à l'université de... au Pays de Galles, non, c'est comme dire un Breton qu'il est Marseillais. Donc, Wales is the red bit, and the English, the enemy, are in green there. So-called enemies, really. So, I talked about maps. This is Penryn Castle. Ah, ça y est, acting up. Il veut pas. No. L'ordinateur fait ce qu'il veut. Bon. Okay. I talked about maps, and there are several images of slave trail, Britain, Bristol, London, etc. We'll have a look later on. But what I wanted to say is that associating slavery and tourism drew the attention of scholars. And slave tourism comes under the label thanatourism or dark tourism. In 1996, an article written by Dan Seaton, he argues that thanatourist is, quote, motivated by the desire for actual symbolic encounters with death. Another article that looks at slavery contested heritage and thanatourism shed light on the question of dark tourism. It examines the ways in which slave sites have become a terrain for heritage politics. Seaton suggests that there are several kinds of thanatourists. Who are thanatourists? They are people who travel to watch death, people who travel to sites after death has occurred, Auschwitz, people who travel to look at memorials, graves, monuments, people who travel to see reenactments, civil war, etc., people who travel to places where death has been reconstructed, and these are, for example, museums. These scholars were concerned with the ethical question related to these sites of memory, in other words, making money out of atrocities. The second point of interest was the dissonant discourse. How does one reconcile competing discourse on the same subject? For example, how can one promote the architectural beauty of southern plantations in the US while exposing the abuses of plantation lives, as shown by Stephen Small, but he's not here, unfortunately. The other point Dan and Seaton raised was the conflict between heritage and history, patrimoine et histoire. They argue that history was a selection of facts. Heritage, patrimoine, was a selection of history. So heritage was a selection of a selection. What this implies, I want to add, is that heritage is an artificial construction subjected to current political, social, and cultural trends. So if sites of memory are indeed places where memory is constructed and presented to the community, sites of memory are places where identity is displayed and enacted. European sites of memory related to slavery avoided, for many of them, tackling questions of race and discrimination. We clearly see that sites of memory are still a locus for power struggle around questions of national identity, cultural diversity, race, ethnicity, etc. I'm thinking of Prime Minister Cameron's idea of Ireland story. As we can see, with all these examples, the memory of slavery in contemporary Britain seems to be painful. I might add that I wrote an article that is online, and it's about trauma site of memory used to pacify the masses so that people avoid talking actually about race, because that's what it's about. I'm nearly finished, actually. This is what it's about, race, identity, discrimination. So if you focus on site of memory, on commemoration only, and you completely take away the idea of race, well, then they might be void and sanitized in some ways. I think that's perhaps what Christine was trying to say, but I'm not sure. She's not here, so she can't fight back. So to conclude, I'd like to conclude on this idea of trauma site of memory. Cathy Carruth shed light on... Oh, computer's completely blocked. Never mind. Shed this light on the idea of trauma site. When working on trauma site of memory, trauma site of memory are, for example, what Anna, you showed, burial grounds and things like that. They're considered to be trauma sites of memory. And drawing on the work of Jeffrey Alexander, Tracy Walker argued that so far trauma sites have been one-dimensional. Whose trauma is indeed displayed? Gilroy and Walker raised the question about white trauma when it comes to slavery. Victimhood displayed in certain sites, amnesia shown in others, do also have an impact on so-called descendants of perpetrators. So they see them as descendants of slaves, victims, and the other side, perpetrators there. So the trauma has an impact on the ways in which that part of the Atlantic history is represented or not represented. Paul Ricoeur also talks about, as previously mentioned, too much memory and trop plein de mémoire. There would be such a thing as too much remembrance. He pointed out that when there's too much remembrance, the value associated to commemorations loses its grip on the population. Commemoration become meaningless or even, as I said, sanitized at the limit of memorialization, hence the article. So the vandalized site of a slave grave in Lancaster, or even in 1998, the statue of a free black man in Nantes, mentioned in Renaud's article, could be, to borrow Dylan Trigg's, a ruin. Museum, therefore, becomes ruins. How so? If museums do not include counter-narratives, even radical ones, what should be done then? Even museums have become sanitized in many ways. So I'm arguing that they should be able to include even radical discourses to actually display a plurality of voices there. in these cases, when we talk about trauma, we talk about healing processes, right? So in these cases, the healing process should not rely solely even on sight of memory. I believe that questioning, challenging the representation of the memory of slavery through memorial, ceremony, trauma sites, slave tourism, books, etc., is still a very important thing to do. More than ever, a plurality of approaches is essential. I'd like to end with food for thought. The current pressing question of European reparation is a challenging one. It establishes what I see as crucial, a link between collective responsibility, collective remembrance, but also, and truly for me that's the most important bit, social justice. So when working on memorialization of slavery, we need to bear that in mind. What is the end result? Remember, to what end? That's it. Thank you.
Très bien. We are going now to open the conference to the floor. Those who have questions, please raise your hand. And there is a microphone in the room. Il y a un micro dans la salle. Et pour ceux qui ont une question, puisque personne ne lève la main pour l'instant, je vais en profiter. Alors, c'est le privilège du modérateur. I would like to, well, not to challenge you directly, but to challenge Paul Ricoeur's idea of, an excess of memory or remembrance when he talks about, having too much remembrance could lead to even, memories loss of value. And the question I ask is, how do we assess the level of memory? In other words, what are the criteria to decide whether there is a deficit of memory or an excess of memory? Whose responsibility is it to decide, that there is excess of memory or deficit of memory?
He argued that institutions should be able to do that work. However, what is interesting for me is that it's a question of positioning. Who are these institutions? Who's represented in these institutions? Are they actually representing the voices of the nation, the voices of communities? They're supposed to represent everybody, but we also know that they don't. So that's why I'm using Ricoeur, because you can argue that this is a positioning that is actually based on somebody who talks from a position of power rather than minority discriminated group. Il va parler de Ricoeur, je le sens.
Ariella Gross first. Et puis après, on va laisser l'avocat de Ricoeur.
A comment and a question on the excess memory. It seems to me that much of the discussion of excess memory has been about Holocaust memory, right?
Yes.
And there, I think there is a legitimate question of when Never Forget becomes politically, pushes politics in an unfortunate direction of imagining a victimhood being constrained by an idea. So I think for American Jews, the idea of which I'm one, the idea of Never Forget has become damaging by overtaking politics. To imagine victimhood even in situations where Jews are no longer the victims, and so it stops being a position of empathy and starts being a position of of martyrdom that's not politically useful. And and so when I've written about that comparison of memory, it seems to me that when it comes to the memory of slavery, we're so far from that place, right? Mm-hmm. We're coming from a place where the forgetting has been so long and strong that it's hard to imagine when there's going to be an excess of memory, right? So that's just a comment that I think there are situations where there can be an excess of memory, but it's not the case for slavery, and it's hard for me to picture when that day would be. The question was about, I was curious, when you were talking about the showing the houses and the plant and talking about the plantations. So there's been an interesting debate in the U.S. Recently among historians of slavery about terminology. With the recent book by Ed Baptist suggesting we should no longer talk about plantations and instead talk about labor camps and, you know, change our way of talking about, because he argues that language of plantation has to, you know, can't be separated from that romance of moonlight and magnolias and Southern heritage in the U.S. South, that it's been so romanticized. And let's call these what they really were, labor camps. Others have then said, you know, no, we should use the language of the time, and a labor camp is a different, you know, sociologically speaking, a plantation and labor camps are different. But it's just, it's generated, I think, this very, very interesting debate. And I'm just curious, well, both whether in the British context these debates are happening, but also just what you think about that kind of question of renaming, and especially when it comes to heritage.
Words are important, but it means different things to different, not only people, but cultures. It might make sense in the American context. However, in the British context, using plantations shows us, I mean, send us back to the Caribbean, and the word is still strong and meaningful for all people. And it actually, it's important to keep that word. Labor camp would be something that is very modern. It doesn't diminish the pain or whatever, but it's very modern. As a historian, that wouldn't make sense, really. However, I understand why the debate has taken place in the South, well, in the States, rather. As for the excess of memory, I'm not sure that... there is such a thing as an excess of memory, because from the start, memory is a, that's what I showed for my through my dissertation, is a political tool just as much as a social and cultural tool. So there's always, to me, it seems to me, there's always a political dimension to it. Therefore, the excess of memory for some groups and people from the Jewish community, it's like a preventative tool. So that, you know, we don't forget, but don't repeat it. Okay.
Lorsque Ricoeur parle de, d'excès ou de défaut de mémoire, il se situe plutôt du côté d'une éthique hein, de la mémoire, avec cet horizon d'une mémoire juste, bon, à supposer qu'on puisse l'atteindre. Et Abdoulaye a parfaitement raison. Ce qui peut être vécu par un groupe comme étant un défaut de mémoire par rapport à certains événements peut être vécu comme un excès par rapport à d'autres. Alors, on peut quand même s'accorder, par exemple, dans le cas de l'esclavage en France, que jusqu'à une certaine période, par exemple, l'accent mis sur l'importance de l'abolition, ce que j'appelle le régime mémoriel abolitionniste, effectivement, a occulté d'autres formes de régime mémoriel, notamment qui met la focale sur la souffrance des esclaves. Donc là, certains pourraient dire, à juste titre, effectivement, qu'il y a une forme d'excès du régime mémoriel abolitionniste au détriment d'autres formes. Mais effectivement, si on se situe d'un point de vue sociologique et historique, c'est profondément variable en fonction des groupes, hein, bien évidemment.
Oui, la question du positionnement, en fait, voilà, est cruciale.
Tout à fait.
Martin.
Yeah. I think the problem is not excess of memory, but what Olivette refers to as the politics. It's what we do with memory. The question is not too much Auschwitz, but or even the slogan, never again. It's what never again means. Does it mean never again to Jews, or does it mean never again to anybody? Does it mean never again in Rwanda? Does it mean never again to Arab people? And memory affects, I mean, we are focusing on memories of slavery, but memory is involved in political discourse in many ways. Perhaps the most misused event in modern times is Munich in 1938.
Yes.
And the notion that never again is used to justify various very military approaches to questions that can be resolved. The parallel, the reading of the event is not wrong, and nor is the memory wrong. Yeah. It's how we use that event.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yes.
Crystal?
Thank you so much. This is so interesting. I have been, you know, focused on France for quite some time, and every time I try to think about the British case, I get really confused. So I would like to... well, first I'll make a comment, and then I have a question. So my first comment is, I was impressed to really see what you did with all of these, you know, different, you know, well-cited and highly cited folks in the field of memory studies, because these are people whose work that I've been reading for years, and I got so frustrated with it because they don't think about race. And so that's a question. I'm a little curious to know, like, what your being in this literature and really trying to engage with it as you do, given that you are so interested in race, I'm wondering what that experience has been like for you, just epistemologically. That's one question.
Okay.
Another question is going back to the British-French thing. So I would like, because you ended talking about race and specifically about the avoidance of race in these sites of memory. And, you know, I've thought about race avoidance in the French context, and you know a lot about it, both intellectually and from living here. So I would like to push you, really ask you, beg you, to help me better understand the mechanisms of race avoidance in Britain and the differences between those mechanisms in France, or do you see more similarities? You know, you talked about the fact that there are racial statistics, for example. So there are there's official recognition of race in a way that France may never have. I don't know. So we can't use that as, you know, as the mechanism. So I want to know more about that. And there was a last question, but it will probably come to me later. Oh, the last question has to do, and it's probably connected, but with power.
Yeah,
and this is getting maybe a little bit to Martin's mentioning of politics, but if there was any similarity between the cases that we've heard so far, it's that black folks don't have power in the nations in which the history of slavery is being commemorated. And so I would just like to know more about black folks' relation to power or lack of power in the British case and what that has to do about the specific forms of memory and forgetting and commemoration that we see there.
Okay, let me try and remember. The first one was about. Okay. I use them and I love using them because precisely there's the lack. The lack reveals something, tells us something about society, tells us something about the intellectual legacy as well, which means that if I use them and apply what they're saying and put some race in it, it gives another perspective into not only the society, but to the fact that we, as minority, me as a minority ethnic person, I can actually twist their word and apply them to me. It's a bit like talking about humanism, universalism, and not applying it to me. But if I apply it to me and send it back to you, you have to address it then. Okay. I found out when I was doing my PhD that some of the references are key to intellectuals in France. If I do put them, I have a wider audience. I know it's calculating, but this is how it is. A wider audience. And then if I frame it in a way that is understandable and applicable to certain case studies, then they would understand where I'm coming from, not just stay in the generalized, you know, in the up there, you know. So, yeah, I find them interesting, and I would still use them, but it's for me a tool to sort of a counter narrative, fight back. The second point was about
comparing the British and French cases.
Yes, it's very interesting because the well, we know about the French context, but the British are pretty open, as I said, about statistics and things like that. However, these are recommendations. For example, they wouldn't dream of telling any group to hire more black people. These are recommendation, but because of the British culture, it's not acceptable not to do it. It's beyond politeness. You're not well seen. It's the question of perception in society. British pride themselves of being highly intellectual when it comes to human rights and things like that. So these are recommendations. In other words, they're not forced to do it, but they will do it to a certain extent. But because it's not affirmative action, then some people can get away with it. That's why there are very few, although we have statistics and we know where the problems are. But, you know, in France, I'm not sure that, well, we know about the Republican model and things like that. You can't force people to hire people on the basis of their color. It has to be, well, we all know it has to be on meritocracy, I'm guessing. However, what the French do not understand is that it's also based on meritocracy in Britain as well. But you have society showing you a mirror to look at yourself constantly. There's that constant dialogue between society and the data. So you have to confront it at some point, but you're not forced to. No, not clear.
No, I guess I'm trying to understand specifically about issues of commemoration.
Okay.
Yeah. In terms of how race is dealt with.
So okay, what I would say...
Race avoidance when it comes to slavery, if they recognize it in statistics, I guess.
The one thing I would say as well is that British society is impregnated with the Protestant ethos as well. So this idea of commemoration is the idea of atonement. You have to do it publicly. And you have to, from atonement, from atoning from your sins, you have to move forward.
Move on.
You express your regret, then you can move on. Until you do that, well, you can't. So you have to do that bit of ceremonial commemoration and things like that.
So it's remembering to forget.
Yeah, in a way. Yes.
Symbolically move on.
Yes.
Apologies.
Not as clear cut as that, but yes, that's the, yeah.
So, sorry to interrupt.
Okay.
We could take two more questions because we have to finish by 10:50. So, two more questions. Michael.
Cameron, Prime Minister of England, recently said, I believe 2 weeks ago, that on the matter of Jamaican claims for reparations, Caribbean claims for reparations in general, that they ought to just simply get past it. They ought to just simply forget about it and move on. And I'm wondering if this ties in with Crystal's point.
Well, actually, we talked about it earlier on. We sort of looked at that point where, yeah, it's completely linked. It's been we've commemorated, we've had ceremonies, we've done all that bit. We've even had massive amount of money dedicated to commemorations and sites of memory. Now we need to look at trade. But it doesn't work that way, as we know, because there's still the debate about reparations that Cameron and just like François Hollande and other head of states refuse to address. And as you know, there's a group of solicitors from CARICOM who signed Britain to court about it. So the question of reparations is really a hotly debated issue at the moment as well.
That reminds me, actually, the American Senate, you know, position with regard to the issue of reparation, because in 2008, the U.S. Senate acknowledged, you know, the tragedy that slavery was and apologized for that. But also it precisely said this could not be a ground for any reparation. So I think that, you know, most of these Western nations involved in the slave trade have pretty much the same position with regard to the issue of reparations.
They agree on that, actually, because there was a meeting several years ago at Brussels about a common policy and stand on the question. So.
Right. All right, donc ce qu'on va faire, on va vous remercier, on va prendre une pause de 10 minutes et puis après on revient pour écouter la présentation de Renaud Orcade. Merci.